You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about the armies of human workers who fool you into thinking that AI is magic.
For the AI behind autonomous vehicles to understand the difference between cars, traffic lights, and pedestrians, every frame of the archives used to train these systems has to have the appropriate objects, people, signposts, cats, trees, other cars, labeled with near-perfect accuracy.
For 1 hour of annotated footage, it takes 800 human hours to annotate that footage correctly.
Wait for that. Everybody's talking about Elon Musk's weird new job in the Trump administration. But did you know that Justin Trudeau created something called the Artificial Intelligence Secretariat? Just this past summer, Trudeau appointed Canada's first Deputy Secretary for AI, a guy named Mark Shawn. Now, most people who follow AI would agree that government needs to be involved with it, primarily with respect to regulating it. And, indeed, this guy says that part of his role is safeguarding against the risks of AI. But digging into the guy a bit and reading what he's said to the press about his goals, it's all about advancing Canada's global leadership in AI and spreading AI further across the federal government and, quote, distilling real impact zones. He says that everybody's focus on AI risks can shut out innovation. You get the sense that this guy is much more about pushing AI than regulating it. And beyond what he says, there's like the way he says it. I mean, How exactly does one distill an impact zone? Honestly, there is so much hocus-pocus and hype around this technology. For me, it's gotten in the way of getting my head around it. Like everybody, I have played with AI. I have found it to be pretty neat. But, you know, for my purposes, it's a toy that has already lost much of its novelty. Just you wait, I'm told. I'm told that both by the people who love AI and by the people who hate it. Those who love it tell me that AI represents nothing less than a major leap forward in human achievement and human consciousness itself, and it is about to change everything. Meanwhile, those who hate it tell me that AI is an Oppenheimer-level man-made threat to humanity, and it's about to change everything. And nobody has adequately explained to me exactly why it is these things, or even what it is, really. Like, what is artificial intelligence? Could you explain it to an 8-year-old if you had to, or, you know, to me? For starters, what does AI look like? Might sound like a dumb question to ask about a technology that we do not think of as even having a physical existence. But it's actually a question with an answer. And today you're going to hear that answer. Because AI is not post things. It is not something that exists without atoms, without solid objects that we can see and touch. Some of those things are machines, and some of those things are us. Our senior producer, Bruce Thorson, has this one for you. Wait for it.
A few months ago, Mark Zuckerberg's Meta released an ad for one of their new AI systems.
Design a training program so that I can run a marathon.
What can I see with a telescope from Cedar Lake?
In it, a rotating cast of shiny, happy people ask their even shinier phones advice on directions, recipes, translation.
Oh, yes, let's do that. Yeah.
Imagine a treehouse.
In a big oak tree with a porch and a ladder.
Imagine Little Italy in 1954.
Hey, Mira. Look at these.
What really struck me about this ad was the ending.
It starts with an empty prompt that takes you as far as you want to go.
As if that empty prompt is a question mark, just hoping you'll shape its direction. As if the AI you're holding in your hand came from nowhere. Just floating in a cloud somewhere. Like that metaphoric cloud, the AI that desires your prompt floats free and clean above the concerns of the world. But before we go much further, I have a couple introductions I want to make. First, James. James, who are you and what do you do?
My name's James Muldoon. I'm an associate professor in management at the University of Essex and I live in East London. I'm an AI researcher primarily and my work interrogates the nature of AI supply chains. How is AI built and what processes are involved?
And Dolores, a few words about you.
My name is Dolores. I'm an AI narrator, self-described as soothing, adult, feminine. I'll be reading extracts from James's book, Feeding the Machine.
Dolores will dip into James's book now and then to quote things. Things like this.
In the public, AI is associated with images of glowing brains, neural networks, and weightless clouds, as if AI itself simply floated through the ether. We tend not to picture the reality of the constant heat and white noise of whirring servers loaded into heavy racks at energy-intensive data centers, nor the tentacle-like undersea cables that carry AI training data across the globe. AI has a material body and exists only through new chips, servers, and cables being manufactured and added to the machine. And just like a physical body, AI's material structure needs constant nourishment through electricity to power its operations and water to cool its servers. Every time we ask ChatGPT a question or use an internet search engine, the machine lives and breathes through this digital infrastructure.
So if you've ever wondered what Siri looks like...
Close your eyes, clear your mind. Well, that's what I look like.
Wow. So Siri can bull... Close your eyes. Clear your mind. That's what I look like. What the hell does that mean? According to James Muldoon, Siri does actually have a real body. And it's a sprawling, energy-sucking mass of whirring servers that casts her tentacle-like undersea cables around the globe.
Siri, what's the name of the guy I had a meeting with a couple of months ago at Cafe Grinnell?
You met Zach Wingate at Cafe Grinnell.
Hey!
Zach!
Wow, I didn't think you'd remember me.
Yeah, of course. As soon as I saw you, I'm like, it's Zach. Nobody looks like Zach.
So the woman in the ad pretends to remember the guy's name, but is actually prompted by Siri. And when Siri can't remember a name, Siri is actually prompted by an invisible army of laborers, actual humans, who'll figure it out for the AI. In true Matrix style, Siri's tentacle-like undersea cables are feeding off the knowledge of thousands, tens of thousands of humans. Actually, you can choose your own dystopian adventure here. Keanu Reeves' Matrix or Star Trek's Borg. Whatever suits you. Anyway, Dolores has something to say. Actually, Dolores is feeding off the hard work of real human James Muldoon. Cue Dolores.
We also tend to forget that behind the seemingly automated processes of AI often lies the disguised labor of human workers forced to compensate for the limitations of technology. When Siri does not recognize a voice command, or when facial recognition software fails to verify a person's identity, these cases are often sent to human workers to establish what went wrong. And sophisticated software functions only through thousands of hours of low-paid and menial labor, workers are forced to work like robots in the hopes that AI will become more like a human.
Speaking of humans, I'd like to bring in James Muldoon.
You know, this data has to be prepared and produced, and often this requires a lot of manual labor. I think when we imagine AI and we kind of think about how automated it is, how intelligent it is, most of us would never suspect that behind this technology lay all of this kind of very menial, very tedious human work.
The sensors that the Waymo driver uses are incredibly powerful, using a combination of LiDAR, cameras, and radar, which allows the Waymo driver to visualize the world around it in milliseconds to a high degree of accuracy.
Then, with a strong foundation derived from artificial intelligence, the Waymo driver crunches all that data and calculates a safe route while responding in real time to the evolving traffic environment.
For the AI behind autonomous vehicles to understand the difference between cars, traffic lights, and pedestrians, they need to be fed millions of correctly tagged examples showing the relevant objects in a variety of circumstances. Every frame of the archives used to train these systems has to have the appropriate objects, people, signposts, cats, trees, other cars, labeled with near-perfect accuracy.
For 1 hour of annotated footage, it takes 800 human hours to annotate that footage correctly. That means drawing all those boxes around it, making sure that machines are able to read it, and that the accuracy levels are extraordinarily high, because you wouldn't want a machine to effectively misinterpret an object out on the road. So that's what data annotation is. Huge amounts of human work doing very messy, very fiddly, but also quite short and simple tasks that are required to make AI possible.
This is tedious, mind-numbing work. Basically, if you can imagine a call center, a cubicle farm, where hundreds, thousands of workers are lit by the glow of screens, hour after hour, day after day, month after month, labeling mundane, often minute, video objects. A tree, a cat, a car, a stop sign. And the workers themselves are in a sense automated as well, because they have to process X number of videos per hour, per minute, to keep their jobs. But who is doing this work, and where exactly are they? Numbers are hard to come by, but Muldoon estimates that there's hundreds of thousands of people spread across the globe to make AI happen. For the most part, the work is farmed out to the global south.
How is this undertaken then? What kind of working conditions do people have? You know, along with a whole range of other back-end office work, during the 1990s, all of this work was outsourced to countries predominantly in the global south. You know, many companies sought to find cheaper and more flexible ways of having this work undertaken. And, you know, first and foremost, that meant, you know, call centers in India, various Excel spreadsheet kind of work being done by workers in Kenya, in the Philippines. A lot of these, you know, firstly former British colonies where English language is widely taught and wages are very low. You know, these were the ideal conditions that people were kind of looking for. So when we think about AI and this kind of data annotation work being outsourced, it follows a long line of this work being kind of delivered to different parts of the global economy, places where it was just more profitable and efficient for these companies to do so. But what has actually happened when we visited one of these AI data annotation centers is, you know, the work is done for incredibly low wages. You know, the workers were getting little more than a dollar US an hour, and under really appalling conditions. Workers were on very short-term contracts, so all the workers were terrified that at the end of their contract they would be dismissed and they would no longer have a job. And this was kind of used as a labor management technique to kind of force the workers to work more efficiently.
That's the annotators, the tens of thousands of people laboring in cubicle farms, mostly in the global south, who are making sure you don't notice a bump in your driverless car experience. But there's another group of people training AI data who see far worse things than signposts and pedestrians.
You're not doing anything, you
The other group of largely unseen AI laborers are the content moderators.
Context is everything. It's not simply the words you use, but the sentiment infused in those words that can make the difference between laughter and tears. At GoBubble, we believe that by understanding emotional context, we can help our clients build safer, healthier, and kinder communities. Our solutions use proprietary emotion-based AI models for good, identifying and muting toxic content such as racism, hate speech.
A slightly different form of AI data work called content moderation. And this might be looking at explicit photos on Facebook or other social media platforms and moderating these and finding, you know, trying to detoxify the internet by, you know, essentially trying to tag these and remove these from social media websites. So in addition to the work being very monotonous, very boring, very tedious and done for little pay and for very long hours, you know, sometimes this work could be very distressing as well, because in addition to building these systems in the first place, a lot of these workers had to try to detoxify them as well.
The most disturbing thing was not just the violence, another moderator told us. It was the sexually explicit and disturbing content. Moderators witnessed suicides, torture, and rape almost every day, commented the same moderator. You normalize things that are just not normal. Workers in these moderation centers are continually bombarded with graphic images and videos and given no time to process what they are witnessing. They're expected to action between 500 and 1,000 tickets a day.
These are essentially the janitors of AI, underpaid, largely unseen, but providing a crucial service.
How about generate an image of a cat playing guitar?
Is that how it works? Am I doing AI?
Yeah, it just does whatever you type.
What are last-minute gift ideas you can make with arts and crafts?
Plan a workout routine to get bigger calves.
Help me think of titles for my tell-all memoir.
What's something smart I can say about Renoir?
Generate another image of a cat playing guitar.
If a girl calls me a snack, how do I reply?
Yeah, that's how it works. You're doing AI.
Make this email sound more professional before it hits send.
Moving on from the human toll of AI, it's time to consider the environmental costs.
We tend not to picture the reality of the constant heat and white noise of whirring servers loaded into heavy racks at energy-intensive data centers, nor the tentacle-like undersea cables that carry AI training data across the globe.
Yeah, so AI also requires a vast amount of, you know, physical and material infrastructure in order to function, things like data centers, supercomputers. And the environmental impact of AI is something that is, you know, getting more and more attention.
The International Energy Agency estimated that in 2022, data centers and data transmission networks consumed 2 to 3% of the world's energy, the equivalent of the total electricity consumption of France or Germany.
And there's also the water needed to cool these data centers. AI is thirsty.
A large data center can consume between 11 and 19 million liters of water each day, equivalent to an American town of 50,000 people. In Google's 2023 environmental report, it stated it consumed 5.6 billion gallons of water in 2022, which was a 20% increase on the previous year. Bruce?
Yes, Dolores?
Can I point out something?
Sure.
You said just now that AI is thirsty.
Correct.
And that Google alone used 5.6 billion gallons of water in 2022.
Correct.
I don't mean to sound obvious, but you must be aware then that every word you have me say means that I'm sucking up water somewhere.
Thanks, Dolores.
You know, every drop counts after all. It's actually the users of Google, like yourself, who push the buttons to drain that 5.6 billion gallons of water.
Thank you, Dolores.
At the turn of the decade, in kind of 2019, 2020, a lot of these large tech companies promised that they would be going carbon neutral or carbon negative. They were hoping that they could kind of even potentially, in Microsoft's case, take out carbon that had historically been put in by the company, you know, going back to its founding. And what we've seen over the last 3 to 5 years since AI has become such an incredibly big part of their businesses is that, you know, their carbon emissions have actually increased by 30 to 50% for some of these large tech companies, that when it actually came down to it, despite their promises of reducing their amount of carbon they were emitting into the atmosphere, the necessity of building huge amounts of AI infrastructure, of new data centers, of new forms of powering them, you know, actually led to their emissions, you know, really going right up.
The growth of computational needs has given rise to the expansion of data centers and the creation of enormous hyperscale cloud computing providers, sometimes called hyperscalers. These are huge facilities that have the ability to scale large systems of memory, compute, and storage. This uses a lot of energy and places large demands on the local electricity grid, with a hyperscaler using as much power as up to 80,000 American households.
So the more of these that are produced, the larger the electricity and water demand on very stretched systems. So, you know, this is something that is a pressing concern for many communities across the globe.
Coming up, what happens when the tech motto morphs from move fast and break things to move fast and steal things? As an extraction machine, we've looked at AI extracting labor. We've measured some of the impacts of resource extraction. Now moving on to the pillaging of our collective human heritage, extraction of culture. Or, as Dolores would like to share from the book,
AI companies are essentially selling what they don't own. The value of image generator tools is based on the human originals, ripped from large data sets and monetized on the sly. These companies have adapted the tech industry's famous motto, move fast and break things, to move fast and steal things, while giving little consideration to the human creators who will be most affected. The image generators allow anyone to knock off an artist's style and threaten their livelihoods without any remuneration or credit for using their work.
In the fast-moving world of generative AI, image generation continues to reach new heights. With the introduction of Imagen 3 on Vertex AI, we are launching our highest quality text-to-image model. Let's say we want to generate a photo of a family on an RV camping trip. Maybe we want to capture them sitting around a campfire making s'mores and admiring fireflies in the night sky.
Shucks, good golly, gee, how sweet. A family on a camping trip, a cozy campfire, s'mores, starlight. What could possibly be wrong with this picture?
We're encouraged to see AI as creating something out of nothing, as just this fantastic, near magical machine that we can simply type in a prompt and it will produce text, poetry, paintings, videos, whatever we want, just through the magic of the algorithms and how the technology works. So it takes 1,000 paintings and it kind of works out the way in which it could kind of reproduce something that will pass for what it has seen in its training data. It's a relationship of extraction, of taking something from what previously perhaps had fallen out of copyright or was part of a kind of broad digital commons, or simply belong to a particular individual. It's taking those kinds of ideas, that kind of material, and it's repackaging it for the purposes of producing a product that will hopefully be profitable for these tech companies. So the main move that's actually happening here is very close to theft, if you get what I mean. It's very close to taking something that is not the tech companies, using a kind of sleight of hand by having these algorithms that can repackage the material, and then producing it as the company's proprietary technology.
I tried to get Dolores to provide me with a poignant, reflective sigh here. Sadly, it seems there's some things only humans can do. Anyway, you can do your own poignant sigh at home if you feel like it at this point in the story. We're dangerously close to being submerged in a dystopian world here.
Some of this does sound a little bit dystopian, but I just think that's where we are. I think we do live in a slightly more dystopian world than we did 5 years ago. Both because all of this is becoming more industrialized and commercialized, and the big tech monopolies and the tech cartels really are becoming larger and more closed. When we had the first generation of tech platforms come out, they were starting them in their garages, right? Mark Zuckerberg was coding Facebook in his Harvard dorm room. Jeff Bezos was soliciting like $50,000 from his friends and family to start Amazon. None of that would be possible today, right? To get in the game, you need to have billions of dollars to compete against the current titans. And all of the startups that we've seen enter this space have by necessity been forced to join themselves with legacy tech companies, right? OpenAI exists in its current form because of its partnership with Microsoft. Amazon's investment in Anthropic is another case in point. All of the big tech companies are controlling and exercise a considerable ownership stake over how AI is developing. So if it sounds dystopian, I think that's because it is, because we haven't seen anything like this before, and it's kind of consolidating everything that kind of went wrong with big tech over the first kind of two decades of what we could call the platformization of society.
The goal here was not to dismiss the possible benefits of AI. AI has already brought about real advancements in medicine, and we're sure to see positive developments across a broad range of fields. But once again, James has a few words of caution about the future, based on what we've seen in the recent past. Back when people thought Facebook was cool, and before Google dropped its motto, "Don't be evil."
Just when Google came out with its search engine, and when Facebook and others came out with this idea of social networks, in the beginning, there was so much hype and so much interest in the technology about all the possibilities that it could contain, about how it would change the world. You know, in some ways it did, but in a lot of other ways, it was just basically a new way to deliver advertising. That's kind of what most people in Facebook and Google work on, ways to maximize user engagement and to deliver them more effective and more profitable ads. That's what the greatest minds of our generation are kind of working on. And I think the sad thing with AI is how much all of the incredibly potentially life-changing and world-changing aspects of the technology will be put in the service of what is profitable, and that's just going to be what big business needs it for. And so I think that is kind of, yeah, the sad thing about how AI, I think, is going to develop over the next decade.
Generate an image of a cat playing guitar.
Is that how it works? Am I doing AI?
Yeah, it just does whatever you type.
What are last-minute gift ideas you can make with arts and crafts?
Plan a workout routine to get bigger calves.
Help me think of titles for my tell-all memoir.
What's something smart I can say about Renoir?
Generate another image of a cat playing guitar.
If a girl calls me a snack, how do I reply?
Yeah, that's how it works. You're doing it.
That's your Canada Land. Hope you liked it. You can email me about the show at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. You can follow me on Blue Sky where I post stuff. This episode was written and presented by our senior producer, Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione, along with some original music this week from Tristan. Additional help from Caleb Thompson. Max